Thanks, David. Ray, could you go next door to the room next door, please? Thank you. And to do with me now with step three is to recite with me the third step prayer together. And if you don't know that prayer, it's on page 63, the middle of page 63 in the big book, but I'm sure most of you probably know it. Now, we're going to do this a little differently. We're going to say it exactly as it is, but if you could think of it like this, think of the God of your understanding, whether that's a power or a force or a person like a father. The God of my understanding is like a father God, a God who provides everything I need, a God who has a wonderful sense of humor, and who doesn't let me take myself too seriously most of the time, even though I tend to. And a God who might be answering me back. So we're going to say the prayer kind of slowly. For example, could you imagine what God might say to you if you said, God, I offer myself to thee? What do you think God would say? God would say, I'm delighted. Isn't that wonderful? To build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. God might say, really? You sure? You mean that? Anything at all you want? I mean, anything that I want to do with you, you let me do. And if you were to say, relieve me of the bondage of self, I think God would say, my pleasure be. I'd love to take away the bondage of yourself. Because all I want for you is to do my will. And if I were to say to God, take away my difficulties and name them, you know, all the things, gosh, all the difficulties. And God would say, you know, they're really nothing. They're nothing in comparison to the fact that I love you and you're my kid. And I'd be delighted to take those away for today. Is this the Cinco de Mayo today? Mm-hmm. So God only does he only does one day at a time. Did you know that about God? He never does Sunday before Saturday. It's terrible. I wish he would, but he never does it that way. So I'm just using that for reflection because that has helped me a lot when I'm saying the third step prayer, instead of rattling it off, to think, what would God be saying back to me? So we're going to put ourselves in the presence of this higher power, this God, and so let us recite together the third step prayer to put closure on that first part of the morning. God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I will help. Thy power, thy love, and thy way of life, may I do thy will always. When I say that prayer and mean it, I always have the image of God wanting to do a dance after I do it, you know, and say, oh, at last she's surrendered, you know. What we're going to move into now are the promises of steps 4 and 5. And as you know, step 4 is all about taking inventory and taking a look at ourselves, and step 5 is about giving away the inventory and getting rid of that. What I would like to just point out to you, which you well know, is that built into our disease is this word, called denial. We really would prefer, well, before we got sober, we would have preferred to call it another name. I was hoping that maybe I had cancer or something, because it would be a little bit more respectable than alcoholism. Alcoholism was the worst word that I could think of in the English language. And so I would have called it anything else. And interestingly enough, built into me, because my disease is part of me, built into me is this whole denial system still. And so I would prefer to believe that, no, it couldn't be that. It's not. Not this time. It's called something else, you know. Or somebody says to me, well, that sounds like resentment. I say, oh, no. This needs to be said for her own good. You ever do that one? I'll try my best to show the pictures over there to Kelly's group. Now listen hard. This is a great story. Billy Bixby was rather surprised when he woke up one morning and found a dragon in his room. It was a small dragon, just about the size of a kitten. The dragon wagged its tail happily when Billy patted it on the head. I used to teach second grade. Billy went downstairs to tell his mother. "There's no such thing as a dragon," said Billy's mother, and she said it like she meant it. Billy went back to his room, and he began to dress. The dragon came close to Billy and wagged its tail, but Billy didn't pat it, because if there's no such thing as something, it's silly to pat it on the head. Billy washed his face and hands and went down to breakfast. The dragon went along, but now it was bigger. In fact, it was almost the size of a dog. Billy sat down at the table, but the dragon sat down on the table. This sort of thing was not usually permitted, but there wasn't much Billy's mother could do about it, because she already had said that there's no such thing as a dragon, and if there's no such thing, you cannot tell it to get down off the table. Mother made some pancakes for Billy, but the dragon ate them all. And Mother made some more, but the dragon ate those too. Mother kept making pancakes until she ran out of batter, and Billy only got one of them, but he said that that's all he really wanted anyway. Poor codependent little Billy. Yeah. Billy went upstairs to brush his teeth, and Mother started clearing the table, and the dragon, who was quite as big as Mother by now, made himself comfortable on the hall rug and went fast asleep. And by the time Billy came back downstairs, the dragon had grown so much that he filled the hall. Billy had to go around by way of the living room to get where his mother was. "I didn't know that dragons grew so fast," said Billy. "There's no such thing as a dragon," said Billy's mother firmly. Cleaning the downstairs took Mother all morning, what with the dragon in the way and having to climb in and out of the windows to get from room to room. Now we have a big dragon. Yeah, getting bigger all the time. By noon, the dragon filled the house. Its head hung out the front door, its tail hung out the back door, and there wasn't a room in the house that didn't have some part of the dragon in it. Just all over the place. When the dragon awoke from his nap, he was hungry, and a bakery truck went by. The smell of the fresh bread was more than the dragon could resist. The dragon ran down the street after the bakery truck, and the house went along, of course, like the shell on a snail. The mailman was just coming up the path with some mail for the Bixbys when their house rushed past him and headed down the street. He chased the Bixbys' house for a few blocks, but he couldn't catch it. When Mr. Bixby came home for lunch, the first thing he noticed was that his house was gone. Luckily, one of the neighbors was able to tell him which way it went. Mr. Bixby got in his car and went looking for the house. He studied all the houses as he drove along, and finally he saw something that looked familiar. Billy and Mrs. Bixby were waving from an upstairs window. Mr. Bixby climbed over the dragon's head and onto the porch roof and through the upstairs window. "How did this happen?" said Mr. Bixby. "It was the dragon," said Billy. "There's no such thing," Mother started to say. "There is a dragon," Billy insisted. "A very big dragon." And Billy patted the dragon on the head. The dragon wagged its tail happily. Then, even faster than it had grown, the dragon started getting smaller. And soon, it was kitten size again. "I don't mind dragons this size," said Mother. "But why did it have to grow so big?" "I'm not sure," said Billy. "But I think that it just wanted to be noticed." Got it, huh? Smart people around here. I think that that kind of is what happens to us in step 4 and step 5. I think that we can build step 4 and 5 tremendously out of proportion, and I think when we pay a little bit of attention to whatever is happening inside of us, which the book helps us to do rather well, I think that it gets into kitten size again. And we learn, you know, that we just have to pay attention and take notice to whatever it is that's bugging us, or what our defects of defects might be. In the back of our book on page 544, I'm just telling you this, it's not for looking at right now, really, but there's a story. It's called Freedom from Bondage. And the writer of that story, who seems to be a woman, she talks about the causes and conditions that lead up to that moment. And that's what we need to do when we're looking at step four. When we're new in the program, and some of you, how many of you in this group now, under a year? This is a very personal question. Don't answer it if you don't want to. How many of you have not yet taken step four? Few. Well, a lot of you have. Okay. When we're doing step four, before we take our initial step four, and I have had to find from my life and my sobriety that I've had to take more than one step four, because my first one was awfully shallow. And I was very particular that my sponsor would recognize how clear I was and how well I wrote. And, you know, I bought about 6 notebooks and different pencils and pens, and I really wanted to impress my sponsor. But I find as I grow in my sobriety that more is revealed. And I've just finished taking another fourth and fifth. And I've done that about four times, I think, in sobriety. Some people like to do it once a year. But whatever it is for you. But anyway, when we think of step four, though, whether we're thinking of taking another one or whether we're thinking of taking our first one, usually the first thing that comes into our heads is what?
Fear.
Fear, because we have to be telling somebody about what? About what in ourselves?
Our defects.
What defect? Come on. What's your biggest, darkest secret? You're no different from the rest of us. It's all about sex, right? Come on. Tell me the truth. You all think of sex when you think of step four. You're just like everybody else I know, right? That right in there too? Good, okay. Well, I want to draw your attention to the book. And the book is kind of wise. I always get a lot of attention. I should have told everybody last night I was going to be talking about sex this morning, because everybody always comes back. What the book does, though, it puts everything in kind of in order. It says that there are 3 areas that we need to look at. And the first one isn't sex, interestingly enough. It's the last one. The first one is resentment. And I could, you know how to find this. I'm not going to insult your tremendous intelligence on all of the stuff that you have here. But I'm just going to comment on the fact that this is mentioned so many times in the book, and is mentioned as being the greatest, the number one offender, that if we're into this, that we're shutting ourselves off from the sunlight of the Spirit, and that we'll drink or use again, and that as a result of that we could die. And even if we don't die physically, we will die spiritually. We cut ourselves off from any kind of spiritual growth. It comes, as some of you might know, from 2 Latin words. This is the verb to feel in Latin. Sentire. Some of you old altar boys or whatever might remember that. To feel over again. To re-feel. To rehearse, as Dr. Paul O says, to rehearse for retaliation. To practice. You know, to get into something again. Not to get rid of it completely. When it comes up, and it comes up, and it comes up. I found this the other day, and I thought it was kind of cute. It says, an Irish prayer, maybe some of you have read this. It says, may those who love us, and those that don't love us, may God turn their hearts. And if he doesn't turn their hearts, may he turn their ankles, so that we know them by their limping. That's called resentment, folks, if you're wondering, you know. Where we're really wishing ill to somebody else. We really don't want them to get whatever it is that's coming to them in the world except for bad things. In our book, it's talks over and over and over again about that we must get rid of it. And I could go on here forever talking to you about resentment. But there are some promises in the big book which are very interesting, that tell us what happens when we are sincerely trying to take care of our resentments. They're on page 64, I believe, and I think the first one is says that we get spiritually and mentally straightened out. I believe it's 64. I just have it jotted down here, so I think it is. Yes, in fact, it's at the bottom of page 64. It says, when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. That means that our mind stops racing. We're no longer rehearsing for retaliation. We're enjoying some peace inside of our heads, peace of mind, sleeping better, all of that mentally. And we're looking better. We look better. And I notice that with people who come into the program. When we come in first, you know, we're all scrunched up because we're full of all this thing and we're just filled with guilt and remorse and fear. And we're into a lot of resentment and we're into resentment because we don't want to be in AA or we don't want to be alcoholics or we're resentful because they didn't do it the right way and we've things with parents and things with spouses and things with kids. And it's very messy. But as we get rid of our resentments, we start straightening out. And you notice people physically changing. I've seen that happen in the program. People physically changing. Do you see that ever? Their eyes lighting up and their skin is clearer. They're smiling more. Looking better. There's sort of a joy of living about them. It's wonderful. And there's another promise. That's the first promise, is that we straighten out physically and mentally. And another one is that on page 66, it is, I think at the bottom of the page there, where we kind of recognize the fact that people who wronged us were sometimes spiritually sick. We didn't like their symptoms and the way they disturbed us, but they were sick too. I love that. I love when the book makes a concession to the fact that we're not all wrong all the time. Don't you like that? You know, that there are assholes out there, folks. Thanks to God, there are. They really are. I love this promise because it says, we ask God to help us to show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience that He would cheerfully grant a sick friend, that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. And I think what happens is that I go to my God, my Father, and I say, God, you know, so-and-so is an asshole, whether you believe it or not. And God says, I know, B. I know. They are. They're not too well wrapped. They're not the full shilling, as we say in Ireland. And then I say, could you, God, help me to show this person the same tolerance and pity and patience that I would cheerfully grant a sick friend? And please keep me from acting out my anger. That's what that really means. And God, may your will be done. And then in the second paragraph there it says, we cannot be helpful to all people, but at least God will show us how to take a kindly and tolerant view of each and every one. That's the promise. That God says, yes, B, I'll teach you. I'll teach you. And I believe that my Father takes me by the hand and maybe points out to me somehow, sometimes, the good qualities in the person. And I don't know how you get rid of your resentments, but mine don't go away overnight. Mine lasts a long time. And it takes it's a long, hard road to get through. We'll be talking about this later today when we talk about the amend steps 8 and 9. But it's a long, hard road. But I think that we need to address ourselves to that constantly, to resentment. Because I always think it's gone forever. And you know what? It pops up just like a little puppy dog here at my feet. And it doesn't even ask my permission. It's just to say a happy Christmas or happy Halloween or happy Easter, you know, and I wonder, well, where did that come out of? I thought that was all taken care of. And it comes back again. So we have to keep addressing it. But the two promises are on page 64 and 67 for resentment. And then we look at the second problem in step 4. Which is fear. There are three areas. And the book tells us on page 67 that it's the evil and corroding thread, I think it is, or maybe it's not on page 67, somewhere around there. Is it 67? Okay. Yes, it's the evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. And that's the kind of fears that we don't know what they are, where they came from, why they're there, or who started them, or why we're thinking this way, or we wake up with it. And I overheard somebody saying in a group this morning that fear leaves rather slowly. It doesn't go away forever either. It keeps, you know, and fear sometimes can be all residue of our past, you know, depending on what kind of a family we came from, what kind of responsibilities we did or didn't have, and all the things, you know, old ideas, even good old ideas that we have to start getting rid of, which is what we're trying to do today. We're trying to formulate affirmations so that we'll change our programming in our head. We'll reprogram what goes on in here. We can use these mantras or affirmations to free ourselves of the things that really get in our way. And then we review our fears. We write them down and we figure out, the book tells us this, but it's interesting, I always think to me, that our biggest fear of all, the biggest fear that any of us ever has, is that the fear that self-reliance will fail us. Am I going to look silly? Am I going to look foolish? Is it going to work for me? Am I going to be? What are they going to think? What are they going to do? What's it going to come out like? Fear of the future. Fear of the results. A real codependent problem. Fear of what it's going to look like. And then there's a better way, the book tells us, because we trust infinite God rather than our finite selves, and we're in the world to play the role He assigns. And just to the extent that we do as we think God would have us do and humbly rely on Him. And here comes the first promise of step four, of fear. He enables us to match calamity with serenity. Now, isn't that classy? Imagine all of the calamities that happen to you in your drinking or using days. And He's able to match all that calamity with serenity. God can do that. And then we're asked not to apologize for God, and you know we just believe that God can do for us what we can't do for ourselves, and we let Him demonstrate, we let God show through us or show off through us what He can do, and then we do the fear prayer. Very interesting prayer. This, it says, we ask Him to remove our fear, and direct our attention to what He would have us be. And then at once we commence to outgrow fear. And this is how I do the fear prayer. I say, first of all, I have to name my fear, because I believe that if I don't name it, you know, God wants me to be conscious of it, to try to figure out, what's that fear of? Is it fear I'm going to lose something that I already have, or that I'm not going to get something I don't have? What I'm afraid they're going to think ill of me? Is it my ego that's in the way? What is it I'm really afraid of? And if I can poke out of my insides what I'm afraid of and try to put a name on it. And I usually cannot do that by myself. I need help from my sponsors or from the group or whatever. I need to ask somebody usually, what am I afraid of? And then if I can put a name on it, then I say to my God, God, Father, would you please remove my fear? Now this language here, direct my attention to what He would have me be. I don't know that He would understand that. The God I have is a very familiar God. So I say, God, what kind of a woman would you want me to be? What do you want me to do? What kind of a woman, God, do you want me to be? And if you're a man, you say, God, what kind of a man would you want me to be? And listen to what He might want to be saying to you. And then the promise comes, at once, pronto, at once we commence to outgrow fear. Isn't that great? But I believe that it doesn't go away unless we do that, unless we do it exactly as it's designed, you know, unless we name it, say it out loud, ask God to take it away, and then ask God, what kind of a person do you want me to be? You know. And I believe if God were answering me when I say, what kind of a woman, God, do you want me to be? God would say, I want you to be warm, and I want you to be loving and caring. I want you to stay sober. I want you to be a happy woman. I want you to be sharing. You know, think of that. What kind of a woman, God, do you want me to be? And what kind of a man do you want me to be? And I love this book. You know, God forgive me for rewriting it. But I did anyhow. But I love the way that it's written. On page 68, you know, it's fabulous the way it goes. It says, doesn't mince words at all. Somebody's calling, David. It says, and now about sex. You know, it's kind of like the book is saying, I know you've been wanting to hear about this all along, but now we're going to do it finally, you know. And now we're going to talk about it, it says. And it cautions us not to be unsensible about it. It says, you know, we're trying to be sensible about this because it's so easy for us to get off the track, and we find that there's two opposite opinions. There's the real extreme people and the real rigid people, and then there's the people who are what I call lowlifers, you know, who don't have any conscience at all. But what it's real consoling about on page 69 is that I heard somebody doing this the other day at a retreat I was giving with a priest friend of mine, and we give this together, and this is the way he described it. He says, on 69 says, we all have sex problems. And then he stopped for about 3 minutes, or 3 seconds, I mean. And then he says, we all have sex problems. And then he says, we all have sex problems. And then he said, we all have sex problems. It was very interesting. In other words, it's none of us gets off of this. It doesn't matter if you're celibate for 40 years like me, or if you're in a relationship or out of a relationship or in between a relationship or whatever. We all have sex problems, and the book consoles us by saying we'd hardly be human if we didn't. Isn't that grand? Now what do? We ask God to look at certain areas, and we ask God that we can. We review this, and we always do our reviewing of our conduct with God. And what we're asked to do is to look at selfishness, dishonesty, and inconsiderateness. We're asked when we arouse jealousy and suspicion and bitterness. And what we do is we ask God to look at our attitude. What attitude do we have behind all of this? If our attitude is one of love, and it's one of meaning well and wishing well and wanting well for somebody else, then we let God take care of that. And above all, folks, above all, and this is hard in AA, but I need to say this. It says in the book that we can't set ourselves up. We can never set ourselves up to be the judge of anybody else's sex conduct. We can't do that. Only God can do that. That's God's business. We don't know. We don't know what anybody's doing, what their background is, what happened here, what didn't happen there. We don't know that stuff, and it's not our business. So we have to move ourselves out of the situation, as it says in the book, to be the judge or the arbiter of anybody's sex conduct. What we do is that we go to God, like we do with the fear and with the resentment, and we ask God what it is that we would need to do. And the promise is, at the bottom of page 69, the right answer will come if we want it. Now, the operative part of that sentence is, if we want it. A lot of times we don't want it. We don't want to hear the truth. And at the bottom of the page again, it says that God alone can be the judge of our sex conduct. God's in charge. If we've messed up in our sex lives, and we've made some tremendous mistakes, which can happen, we believe that God can and will take care of that too. We believe that we will be forgiven and we will have learned a lesson. That's our second promise of sex problems on page 70. The main thing, though, is that we pray for the right ideal, for guidance, and for sanity. Because it sounds to me, from what I know, is that the whole issue of sex and relationships, which need not necessarily be connected, but they often are, cause a tremendous amount of insanity. And you don't believe that, huh? Some of you do believe that. Later this afternoon, when we're talking about emotional sobriety, we'll be talking about the basic situation that we find ourselves in. And that is, and I hate to come all the way from California to tell you this, but some of you might know it already, but I'd like to repeat it. There's a fellow in our group who says, there is nothing I mean nothing or nobody out there that can fix us. You know, isn't that kind of naked? Pardon the pun. Isn't it? You know, there's nothing or nobody out there that can fix us. So no matter what, we have to keep going back to this whole thing called about an attitude, being with and being for our higher power. The recipe that it gives us if we're having sex problems is that we get out of ourselves, like we talked about in step three, and we ask again what it is that we can contribute to life. What is it that we can give? And I love the way it says it. It quiets the imperious urge when to yield would mean heartache. The imperious urge that, you know, we're really in there and we're involved and our mind is totally absorbed and we're into another addiction or whatever it is, an obsession, and our heads are going crazy. Our heads can race in millions and millions of directions. And so we have six promises in step four. Two for resentment and two for fear and two for sex. And then we move into step five, which clearly tells us what it is that we have to do. It says that we put our pride into our pockets. It's real hard for us to do this because we don't like doing it. And we try to illuminate. We try to be honest. Now, it used to offend my feelings when they would say, you know, it's not honesty we're talking about here. We're talking about rigorous honesty. There's a big difference between honesty and rigorous honesty, I believe. The difference between being honest and telling the truth. And so we try to put our pride in our pocket and we illuminate, we clearly illuminate every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. And once we have taken this step with holding nothing, the first promise of step five is that we are delighted. Now there are 10 promises in step five, which I would like to tell you, if you don't already know them. And they're all on page 75. The first one is, we are delighted. And the second one is, we can look the world in the eye. What a wonderful promise for us, looking the world in the eye, because we never thought we could. We never thought that looking the world in the eye was something that we would ever do, because we were always so ashamed, and we were always so lacking in any kind of self-confidence. We can be alone and at perfect ease and peace. People like us, we were afraid and upset when we were with other people, and we were the same when we were by ourselves. We just never could fit in our own skin. It's a wonderful feeling to fit in our own skin. I've been fitting in my own skin ever since I came here yesterday. I've been fitting in my own skin now for a good long time. It's really nice to come into a place where you're not all the time in and feel fitting in your own skin. It's a real great gift. The fourth promise is that our fears will fall from us. I always think of that as a layer of skin, you know, old skin that I don't need, and it keeps falling from me. And the fifth promise is that we begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. Sixth one is we may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. And the feeling that the drink problem, sometimes I substitute that for the think problem. Do any of you have a think problem? Do you ever read those 20 questions for the alcoholic? And substitute the word think instead of drink. Have you ever been thinking alone? Has your thinking ever caused you to, you know, those 20 questions? But sometimes it's good to substitute think for drink, because our thought process is what happens now. We may not have had a drink for a long time, but I bet we've had a little think. You know, just a little think. You know, that could set us up for a little drink. That's important to keep in our minds. And the eighth promise is we feel we're on the broad highway. I love this because the book doesn't narrow God down to a little itty-bitty God or to a God of any kind of a religion. I love that. It doesn't have to be a Catholic God or a Presbyterian God or a Baptist God or a Lutheran God or a Jewish God. It's a big God, broad and roomy and all-inclusive and never exclusive. And we feel we're on the broad highway, walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. This is a beautiful promise. We thank God from the bottom of our heart is the ninth promise.
Thank you, can't afford it. Thank again.
So we're getting into some kind of conscious contact. And the tenth promise is, we are building an arch through which we shall walk a free man or woman, person, at last. So we have 10 wonderful promises as a result of step 5, and we have 6 wonderful promises as a result of step 4. What we're going to do now is, we're going to take a look at steps 4 and 5, the promises, in our groups again. But before we do that, I want to draw your attention to the affirmations that came out of step 3. Here's a good one. Since God provides what I need, I have what I need. I enjoy peace of mind through letting go. I live with expectancy, but I have no expectations. You know, expecting a miracle, knowing that God's going to do this because God's in charge. Now, what we're going to do with these affirmations is Teresa's going to type them up for us, and eventually, not today, but she's going to type them up for us, and they're going to be available to you so that you can use some of these for your own prayer meditation. So that when your head gets crazy, you can pick out one or two of those that feels good for you, that you could make your own, you know. Like one that I use a lot is, I enjoy peace of mind. Because I tend to be hyperactive, as you can tell. I jump all over the place. And, you know, every once in a while I get, oh, real hyper. And I think, oh, God, my head's got to stop. And I have so many ideas. They're all good ideas. They're fun things. But I find myself getting very, you know, so I have to say, I enjoy peace of mind. I'm conscious of God's presence. I have to breathe slowly. I have to sit quietly. And I find these affirmations and the promises to be absolutely miraculous. And I never tried to do them with a group like this before. So I'm real pleased with what you're doing with this. You're formulating for yourselves a reprogramming for your minds. And I hope you'll use this. I really hope you'll use them. You wouldn't even need us to type them up. You could find them in the book. But the fact that it's come out of the energy of this group, I think, is real significant. And I think you could use that. So what I'm inviting you to do now is take a look at the steps, promises of steps 4 and 5. Do the same procedure. Share any promises that have come to your mind that you didn't hear of before, that you didn't know about before. Anything in steps 4 and 5 that comes to mind when you share. But what I do want to ask is that you attend, if you can, to writing the affirmations at about 12:20. So if the group leaders, the facilitators could make sure that about 12:20 you write your affirmations so that we'll have affirmations for steps 4 and 5. And we're going to do about 5 different kinds of things, but basically what we're going to address right now are steps 6 and 7. And if you noticed on your program this morning, I put separating the women from the, or the girls from the women and the men from the boys. And the reason I did that was because in step 6 in the 12 and 12, which you don't have in front of you, but it says this is the step that separates the men from the boys. And then it goes on to explain what that all means as far as separating the men from the boys. Now, this is not in your big book. This is your 12 and 12, but you don't have this with you, and you don't need it either. So I'm going to be just using this to refer to it in terms of what steps 6 and 7. In the short time, which is 11 years and almost 6 months that I have, well, excuse me, 11 years and 5 months that I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've made certain observations. Now, I wouldn't want to be taking anybody's inventory, but I do it all the time. You know, I notice sorts of things. I notice like there's what I call the kind of... Who took my pen? My green pen. Anybody got it? Oh, got it. It's okay, Carol. Carol, I have it. It's okay. I found it. Thank you. I've noticed that there are 3 types of AA all over the place. No, it's not yours, Bob. This is it. One is what I call the basic, you know, the basic part where that you get in some particular groups. Now, I don't know anything about your group except I was here last year and I loved it, and I'm here this year and I love it, and I like any of you that I know, and so that's all I know. But I do know, though, all through the country in Alcoholics Anonymous, that there's such a thing as different groups, different types of people in different places. And... I'm telling you this for want of a better way of seeing it, because sometimes I don't know what a group is for, what they're doing, and I don't know what's inside of anybody's head. But sometimes in groups there's what I call the low-life group. I mentioned it this morning. And that is where people come to the program, and obviously there are none of you here because you wouldn't be spending a whole Saturday this gorgeous day doing this. But low-life is when people come to the program and all they're really looking for is a relationship. Have you ever seen any people like that? You've never seen that. It's only in California, I guess, that happens. And all their other energy kind of is going into relationships and figuring things out and breaking up relationships and getting into relationships. And I call that low-life AA. Then there's the second bracket that I have. This is all my own inventory that I take of AA all through the country and other countries too. I just got back a few months ago. I was in Australia, so I took inventory over there too. And I take inventory in England and Ireland and all over. So anyway, the second group is what I call the ho-hummers, the ho-hum group. And they're the ones that get sober, they're clean, life is doing a little bit better for them. They've got their jobs back, and even maybe their husbands or relationships or whatever. Things are, at least they've got food on the table and they've got a roof over their head and whatever. And then it gets kind of ho-hum. There's another word for that you probably know, and it's called boring. Now, I don't know if any of you have ever experienced boring in AA. It's when people are not doing what step six and seven are all about, which I'm going to be telling you about. And then the third type is what I've experienced with you last year, and I feel it this time too, is what I call the classy type. You know, you're real classy here, very serious about the steps, the program, your sobriety. You're very serious about your conscious contact with God, and I call that classy. And I think that that's what I'm after myself. And I stick around the people that have that kind of stuff. They have that happy, joyous, and free. Not 24 hours a day, maybe not 7 days a week, not maybe 12 months in the year, but they do have a certain energy or glint about them and life in them and vibrance about them that I want. I want that stuff. Like a positive attitude. Now, we did a lot of work earlier today in changing this thing here. This is called our head. You know, did you know that? And as I said to you several times already today, that my head would destroy me if it didn't need me for transportation. It really would. It would really be out to get me, because in between my ears, I can start up the greatest scenarios, and they're going to do this, and I'm going to do this, and they have this, and pretty soon I've annihilated several people off the face of the earth. That's what I do. I come from the north of Ireland, by the way, where they fight all the time. That's where I was born and raised, so I don't know how not to fight. We'll be talking about that tomorrow when we do step 10, because one of the promises in step 10 is that we cease fighting. And we're in a position of neutrality. Can you believe that? Somebody like me, ceasing fighting. But why I wanted to talk to you about the three types of AA in connection with step 6 and 7 is that my experience has been that a lot of people in the program, they've told me this, that's how I know that. A lot of people have told me this, that they never get beyond step 5. They never get beyond that. They think it's, they do step 4, which is, you know, your written inventory, and then they give it away. And then it's, goodbye, Charlie, I've done my bit. You know, I might do a little bit of 12-step work here and there, and maybe even a little bit of 13-step work, too. Yeah, a little bit of fun there in between. But having to do with 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11, you know, there's a kind of a, yeah, oh, who needs that, you know, kind of goes off over their heads. So what we're going to talk about, just briefly, is the difference now here between the people who really merge into this whole business and get into working the steps and get the willingness to do some changing. Like it says in the back of your program, it says, the greatest revolution in our generation is the discovery that human beings, by changing the inner attitudes of their minds, I don't believe you can do that if you don't do all the steps. That's my personal belief. And I think it's the belief of the people who wrote the steps, because the 12th step says that as the result of having done all these steps, that the first thing we get is a spiritual awakening. More consciousness, more energy, because as we get conscious, we get energy. And I don't think there's one of you here sitting in this room today that wouldn't want more energy. It's kind of like money, you know? You can't have too much energy, you can't have too much money, you can't be too thin. Is that the way it goes? Something like that. By changing the inner attitudes of their minds, Therefore, we can change the outer aspects of our lives. Isn't that wonderful when we get to know that? Step six is about, as you know here, it's about being entirely ready to have God remove all of these defects of character that we talked about in steps four and five. But what happens when we get to step six? Oh, George has this in the tape. I want to say something bad, but it's okay. You want to turn it off for a second, George? I don't want my bad stuff to be on the tape. When I was in Serenity Hall, in which nobody wants to be angry enough to murder, well, sometimes I do, or lustful enough to rape, or gluttonous enough to ruin her or his health. No one wants to be agonized by the chronic pain of envy or to be paralyzed by sloth. Of course, most human beings don't suffer these defects at these rock-bottom levels. We who have escaped these extremes are apt to congratulate ourselves. What steps 6 and 7 are about is the subtleties, the hidden sorts of things in there. Now, the book goes on to talk about it in the form of what some of you who might have come from a religious denomination, and in many religious denominations, they call that the seven deadly sins. The book refers to the seven deadly sins. And the seven deadly sins are really what I call the subtleties of the program, like in there, you know, the ones that don't look so bad. They look okay. We know we're not doing anything huge, but there's little sneaky things that creep up on us. One of the deadly sins, and I'm not going to go through them all, but one of them is the first one, in fact, is called pride. Well, you know, there's something kind of attractive, I think, about having a kind of a pride in your family, or what you can accomplish, or being responsible, or showing what you can do, or maybe even into bragging or power. We live in a kind of a society, I think, where, you know, it's a go-get-it society. We're almost challenged. Kids are challenged to do that at a very early age. How am I going to, you know, get through this thing called living in this big, wide world? And so it's hard for us to call it what it really is sometimes. And it isn't always that. But sometimes it can be ego taking over, the wrong form of ego. Like, as I've told you before, and you've heard, I'm sure, standing for edging God out. And we move in again, and we take the stage, and we get into the driver's seat again, and we start driving off, and we start playing God again, and we start being purposeful, and we start getting into a tremendous amount of self-reliance. Now, some people think that if we're not self-reliant, that we're not responsible. But we in the program know the difference between being responsible for what we have to do and relying totally and completely on ourselves. There's another one. I'm just going to do a couple of these. Greed is another one. We could call that ambition, the sort of the dress-up name that we could call it. It could be called ambition or getting ahead. Or did you ever see on anybody's bumper sticker, the man or the person with the most toys wins? You know? Kind of subtle, isn't it? Like the acquisition of material goods, and it's called, I'm taking care of my family. You know, we call it, oh, I'm taking care of my family. We have a kind of an attitude that the more I collect in my possession, the better off I'll be. And so on and so forth. To all of these, when we look at these defects, we need to ask the question that we talked about this morning. After we talked about fear, or one of the defects, or one of the things in step four, we need to say, God, what kind of a woman do you want me to be? It's basic. Or what kind of a man do you want me to be, God? And when we get to that point where we can honestly say that and mean it, I think then we can get as far as step six, because we can then become entirely ready to have God remove all our defects of character, things that get in the way of the clarity of God working in us, the clarity of the program. The kind of a transparency where we have no hidden agendas in there, where we're cooking up something, you know, or figuring out something. We're clear. We're transparent. We've got a common problem, and we have a unity of purpose, and we're real sincere about doing that. Now, I don't know where you're at with any of this, but I know for myself that it takes constant monitoring. I need to monitor this constantly and monitor what goes on in my head on a regular basis. So when we get to that, we get what we need all along, what we've needed right from the beginning, but we get even another degree of this, another degree of willingness. I talked to you last night about the day in Serenity Hall in Whittier where I knelt after I got home and I knelt and I prayed and I asked God to give me the willingness to change my attitude. That was the most miraculous thing I ever think ever happened to me. Because that was the beginning of a complete psychic change in me. When I became willing to have God do some changing in me, that was marvelous. It was really a wonderful time. And it didn't happen suddenly. It's still happening. I have to become willing and willing and willing and willing. So step six is about continuing to become willing. And then step seven, I love telling you about this because that's when I found God. Now, I told you last night, and I've told you before, I'm sure you've heard this said by me before, that I have had lots of study and lots of programming in the ways of God. I've done lots of scripture study, lots of theological studies, lots of history, all sorts of studies to do with the things about God. And I knew a lot about God here in my head. But I was never able to make my head and my guts meet as far as God was concerned. And while I really never believed in a punishing God, but I kind of believed that somehow God had my name up here. I don't know exactly how I got this idea. But you know what? I did good stuff. He put a little check mark, maybe, and then, like he was going to trick me or something. I kind of feel that I felt that God was going to trick me. And as I told you last night, my own arrogant belief in my relationship with the higher power was that God was God and I was Mrs. God and I was in charge. And that's just the way it was. I had no problem with that. But when I got as far as step seven, after I became as willing as I knew how to be, I knelt on my knees and I tried to say the prayer that's on page 76. And if you have a book there, you might want to just take a little look at that. Page 76 of the big book. And it says that the very first word in it is my, and the next one is creator. And if you have it there, if you haven't, I'll be saying it anyhow. I want you to think about, you know, what God would say to you if you were to say that prayer and mean it. When we become willing, when we're ready, we say something like this. We say, my creator, I am now willing, because we prayed for the willingness in step six and we assume we got it, that you should have all of me good and bad. Now, I believe that when I got to that point that I met God, and I want to describe this religious experience that I had with you because it was marvelous. And if you haven't done step seven, I recommend it to you because it's absolutely a great freedom. What happened was, I was kneeling in my room. I have a nice bedroom in my convent where I live in California. And I was kneeling down, and I said, my creator, I'm now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. And at that moment in time, my God appeared to me. Now, he didn't appear physically. There was no physical God there that I could touch. And I don't know why God wouldn't appear to me, but it hasn't happened yet. But inside of my being, inside of my innermost being, inside of my psychic self, I saw like a father, or at least I had a sense of a father image. Now, remember I told you I grew up without a daddy, so I needed a father very badly. And it was like this father was saying to me, B, are you sure? Are you sure that you're now willing to have me, to come to me whether you're good or bad? Now, you see, that was my problem. My problem was that I was trying to be perfect for God, and I just thought that I didn't know that you could really come. My self-esteem was so low. My lack of confidence in myself was so terribly low. And I said to God, my creator, I'm not willing that you should have all of me good and bad. And my big father God, who was huge and Irish, of course, said to me in my innermost self, said, B, are you sure? Are you sure that it's okay for you to come to me whether you're good or bad, or right or wrong, or true or false, or whatever, you know, is it okay?
And at that moment in time, I understood what it meant to be loved unconditionally by God. And that was a tremendous relief. And when I forget that today, I still go back and I do this very same thing all over again. And I recall and recapture that moment. And then I remembered that I had spent most of my life teaching other people about a God who had loved them unconditionally. A God who would love them no matter what. I still do this, I used to give retreats to people and tell them, you know, about God loving them no matter what. No matter what they did, it was okay because God loved them and he wasn't going to hoard up their guilt or hold it against them. And I would tell people about the forgiving God, but I never believed it inside of myself because I always felt like that God forgot about me. That I was this little orphan girl who looked like Holly Hobby. You know who Holly Hobby is? And that I had freckles, you know, and he didn't care for freckles. And red hair, and he wasn't real keen on red hair. And somehow he forgot about me. And I always felt just that little bit different, a little tad plum out there somewhere. Not quite fitting, but always performing very well on the outside. That the outsides and the insides never matched. Ever. And at that moment in time when I said that part of the seven-step prayer, then I knew inside of me what I'd been teaching people forever. And what I'd been teaching people was, you know, your God loves you so much that he would call you by your name. He would call your name out. He would say, Martha. Call your name out, and he'd say, Tom, call your names out. He knows about us all. So individually, they would call us by our name. And I would say to people, your God loves you so much that he would carve your name on the palm of his hand, you know. These are all from scriptures you probably recognize. And I would tell people that. And I would have them imagine a big God who was very merciful and very forgiving saying, gosh, look at your hand. God's hand, and God's got Jim written on that on his hand, or he's got Helen, or he's Carol, or, you know, have people's names written on his hand. And then I say to people, you know, your God loves you so much that he would store up your tears. He would store up all your tears, and he would put them into a little bottle. And every once in a while, he would take out this little bottle and he would look at that and he'd say, these are Pat's tears, you know, or these are Anita's tears. And in other words, what I taught people was that God loved us individually with a kind of a real precious love. But I never felt that until I took step seven. Now, don't you think that this program of Alcoholics Anonymous is kind of classy? That it could give somebody like me that kind of an insight and understanding. See, I told you yesterday, and I keep saying this, I almost missed this thing because I was so arrogant. I know you're not, but I was, because I didn't think I needed this. I thought I could, you know, I could stop drinking anytime I wanted to, and I could change my attitude anytime I wanted to, and none of that I could ever do. I could not do it without people like you. Another thing that I discovered was that God and I, just the two of us, God and I could never keep me sober. Isn't that weird? But I needed you too. So God and I and people like you can keep me sober. Isn't that wonderful? I don't have to drink as long as I'm with you guys. But God and I just on our own can't do that. What are you laughing at, Anne?
We were just discussing it.
Yeah. Oh, well, and I wasn't there. So it became kind of clear to me that this whole business was that God somehow would love me unconditionally. But what I need to let you know, too, is that I don't think I would ever have experienced that if I hadn't experienced the unconditional love of the group that I belong to. They love me no matter what. They love me when I was doing temper tantrums, when I was doing arrogance, they would say to me, Would you like to sit here? And I'd say, no, thank you. Would you like to go to lunch with us? No, thank you. They'd ask me questions, and I would say to them, this is an anonymous program. Ooh, man, I had to make so many amends. Oh, God, in the program of AA, it was awful. I wouldn't, you know, and they would, you know, sometimes they would want to hug me. Oh, Wow, that was the worst part. And I'd say, don't touch me. You know, I felt like a cactus plant. Do you have any cactus plants here in this part of the world? Lots of cactus plants out there in California, in the desert areas. And every part of the cactus plant you touch, it hurts you. You know, just sore. It's terrible. But I was like this big cactus, just hurting all over. Hurting, oh, so sore. My body hurted, my head hurted, my back hurted, my neck was hurting, my legs, everything about me was hurting, and my heart, of all, was hurting the most. I was dying with pain. And I love it when I hear people talking about that pain again, because it reminds me of what it used to be like for me, and I remember that it's not like that for me all the time now. Now, there are days that I choose to stay in pain, you know, because I'm not willing to move out of it. But most of the time, I'm not in excruciating pain all the time. You know, I can actually not fight with Delta Airlines, you know, or whatever. Whoever they might be, you know. It doesn't matter. It can be anybody. It doesn't. But I'm not in a lot of emotional pain most of the time. And that's miraculous for me. And that's because I've stayed around people like you. And I've allowed myself to be loved. You might have read recently in some of your newspapers, we had in the Los Angeles Times that they're trying to discover a drug now, which will, you know, all you have to do is figure out, you know, before you're, well, I guess when kids are still in their mother's womb, whether or not they're potential alcoholics or not. And then they can give them some kind of medication and, you know, then we'll all be home free. There won't be any more problems. I don't know if you've read that. We're discussing it at our morning meeting. I go to my home meeting is at 6 o'clock in the morning. If you're ever in California, by the way, make sure you get there. I'd love to meet you. So I leave home at 5:30 in the morning. I'm serious about this thing called sobriety. But we were talking about it, and there was one kind of a newcomer said, "Well, wouldn't that be great? We could take that, whatever it is that they produce, and we wouldn't have to be bothered about this." But you know what I said to him? I said, "You know what, Cliff?" I said, "Cliff, what would we do without the loving? What would we ever do without the loving? There would be no pill that would ever help us to have good feelings about ourselves, like, you know, in that we need the support of one another." And so I believe that because I was able to, somewhere along the line, receive the love of the people in the program, that I was then able to receive God's love, God's unconditional love. I believe that. And so I think it's really important to stick close to the program, to receive and to give at the meetings and to help newcomers. So steps 6 and 7 have been very important for me. What we're going to move into now is a new phase. We're going to move into an entirely new phase of the little workshop we're about. And it's called A New Frontier Emotional Sobriety, which is what I think some of you might want anyhow, right? Earlier this morning, for any of you who joined us this afternoon, I talked about the C word. Do you know what C stands for? Pardon? Codependency. A word that we don't talk about out loud too much in the program because sometimes we get in trouble. But Bill W. wrote a letter on depression, which was published in one of the books that we have. I forget the name of it now. It doesn't come to mind immediately, but it will. And he talks about his deep depression that he had after 20 years of sobriety. Can you believe that? After 20 years. And he was terribly, terribly depressed, and he didn't know how to get rid of it. And he says such things like that, I think that many old-timers who have put our AA booze cure to severe but successful test will find that they lack emotional sobriety. Now, when I talk about classy sobriety, that's kind of what I'm talking about. I'm talking about my emotions sort of coming together. And he says, perhaps they will be the spearhead for the next major development in AA, the development of a much more real maturity and balance in our relations with ourselves, with other people, and with God. And so my belief is that if our co-founders were alive today, that they would be jumping and dancing with joy because of the research and the understanding that's happening regarding this whole business about codependency. I believe that they would be thrilled because that's what he's talking about here, that they would be
we find out other ways, because life goes on, you know. We get to read more, we get to hear more, we get to know more. We get people who are out there in the research field researching more of people who react. People who came from dysfunctional families, how dysfunction works, what effect it has. We have people who have done statistics and research. You know, this is real. I think this is very significant, this business about codependency. And I believe that, basically, inside of all of us, the cry is, if they would only do it differently, then we'd feel better. You know? If they would only just be a little different from what they are. This is what he's talking about. And he says, since AA began, I've taken immense wallops in all these areas because of my failure to grow up emotionally and spiritually. And then he talks about, you know, it's difficult to be ungrown up when you're whatever you are, 40, 50, 60, 30 years of age. And what was appropriate at 17 years of age as an adolescent is not appropriate then. So he couldn't understand why and what was wrong with him and why he couldn't put all the 12 steps to work on all the other problems that he came up with. He couldn't understand that. And then he said, what does it mean it's better to be comforted than to be comforted, like the prayer of St. Francis? You know the St. Francis prayer? And then he realized something that's unbelievable and certainly written in every codependency book that we have. He says, my basic flaw had always been dependence. And I think if he had known it, he would have said codependent. He didn't know. It was not a buzzword of the 50s, you see. So he says, my basic flaw had always been dependence, almost absolute dependence on people or circumstances to supply me with prestige, security, and the like. Failing to get these things according to my perfectionistic dreams and specifications, I had fought for them. And when defeat came, so did my depression. Bill Wilson was like you and I probably are. He wanted what he wanted when he wanted it. Any of you like that here? I want what I want when I want it, okay? And so that was really hard for him when he came to that. And he says, I had over the years undergone a little spiritual development. The absolute quality of these frightful dependencies had never been so starkly revealed. Reinforced by what grace I could secure in prayer, I found I had to exert every ounce of will and action to cut off these faulty emotional dependencies upon people, upon AA, can you believe that? Indeed, upon any set of circumstances whatsoever. Then I could only be free as Francis had been. Emotional and instinctual satisfactions I saw were really the extra dividends of having love, offering love, and expressing a love appropriate to each relationship in my life. And then he goes on to describe how he did that. At the very end, he says, thus I think I can work out with emotional sobriety. If we examine every disturbance we have, great or small, we will find at the root of it some unhealthy dependency and its consequent unhealthy demand. Let us, with God's help, continually surrender these hobbling demands. Then we can be set free to live and love. We may then be able to 12-step ourselves and others into emotional sobriety. Of course, I haven't offered you a really new idea, only a gimmick that has started me to unhook several of my own problems at depth. And nowadays, my brain no longer races compulsively in either elation, grandiosity, or depression. I have been given a quiet place in bright sunshine. And it was only when he found that he was able to do that.